14th, 2002. This is Andy Horowitz here with Al McShirley doing our second interview, and thanks again for doing this.
You're welcome.
So just to give a little background, the point of the story we're picking up now, you talked last time about how this judge, your boss in the juvenile counseling program,
yes,
had sort of encouraged you to quit your civil rights activities or quit your job.
Yes.
And at the same time, you got an offer from the poverty war to start working with them.
Yes.
So can you just tell me, you said the job you got was program director? Was that the first, or what was the job you got when you started working, getting paid by them?
When I first went to work, I was worked for a guy named Ralph Showalter, who was a UAW organizer. Jack Conway, who was one of the leaders of the UAW, was Sergeant Shriver's assistant over at OEO. And the LBJ had made this deal to try to neutralize and co-opt the Kennedy faction in the Democratic Party by giving them the poverty war, basically. And so that was Sergeant Shriver was the director, who was a Kennedy brother-in-law, and then the UAW, which was the organized union base of the Kennedy wing of the Democratic Party, was also given a whole lot of good jobs and patronage in the poverty war, both in Washington and around the country. And Ralph Showalter, who'd come from Detroit, was hired at UPO to help the United Planning Organization, which was in charge of the poverty war in the Washington metropolitan area. Was kind of a deputy director there, and he hired me to help him. He didn't know his way around Washington very well, and I knew my way around the suburbs some at that point. And the problem that the United Planning Organization had was to try, it was kind of in a goldfish bowl because it was right there in Washington. Everybody's looking at this new poverty war to see whether it would, it was true that the government would fund a revolution against itself. There were some of us who thought that was a not probable, but we thought we would give it a chance for a few years. And Mr. Showalter came out and interviewed me in Gum Springs. He'd heard about the stuff that we were doing in this black community that I think I talked about last week.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we had a newspaper coming out. We'd formed a community action group and had a board and got nonprofit status. And he says to me, Al, are you willing to try to do this all over the suburbs, do the same thing you're doing in Gum Springs? And I said, oh, I'd love to. And then he told me he'd pay me. I think I was getting $5,000 a year as a probation officer. And he said they'd pay me $8,000, I think, almost twice as much money for doing what I was doing for free. I couldn't believe it. I thought and of course, as you just said in the intro, I'd just been encouraged to look for another job by my boss. So that came in just time. My marriage was breaking up about that same time in 64 with Carol. And this was actually before LBJ got elected in November of 64. And I went to work for UPO, I think, in the spring, like in JFK was killed in November of 63, and one of the first things LBJ did and was to co-opt this kind of Kennedy movement, partly I think his heart was in the right place, you know, was to push this poverty war idea. And it actually was passed, Economic Opportunity Act was passed before the elections in 64. Bobby Kennedy had helped draft the bill and had been working with the Ford Foundation and other people for about 2 years from 61 to 63 on developing this design of this poverty program. And so Ford Foundation had funded United Planning Organization and gotten it started, the whole theory being there were two or three areas in the country. One was in New Haven.
Really?
And Paul Ilvesacker was the key person behind the design of the poverty program. And there was an excellent program in New Haven that had begun in 61 and 62. I can't think of the name of it. And then mobilization for youth in New York City, partly in Harlem and partly in Bedford-Stuyvesant, and then UPO in Washington. And the Ford Foundation had funded all this with the theory being that there was going to be all this federal money that was coming down soon. Very, very interesting program. Before I forget it, I've been thinking about writing a newspaper column called Deja Vu all over again, because when Nixon won in 69, which is going to be the bookend of today's interview, guess who Nixon made as the poverty war director, in other words, took Sergeant Shriver's place, was a young man named Donald Rumsfeld. And it was his job basically to shut down the war on poverty. Sort of like Clarence Thomas was put in charge of the EEOC to shut down any efforts by the federal government to do away with discrimination in the workplace. So you had these programs that were designed to do something, and when the Republicans took office, they, instead of just being up front and saying we're going to close, you know, we don't believe in these programs and we're going to just shut them down, instead they would leave them running and put people in charge of them to teach, the agencies that had never done anything to eliminate poverty, how to get around some of the new laws that had been passed to try to do something about poverty, or how to get around the anti-discrimination laws. And that's been the Republican strategy, you know, ever since 1969. At any rate, I took this job with UPO, and my first efforts where I would drive around, just go to meetings. I knew a lot of the civil rights activists in the two Maryland counties, Prince George's and Montgomery County, and then the Northern Virginia counties, Alexandria, Arlington, Fairfax, Loudoun, and Prince William. And, I mean, I knew everybody who was doing any direct action stuff. And I would call them up and say, hey, I got this new job, and I'm going to help us get some money to organize. And, you know, I would encourage people. And a lot of people just had read about it or heard about it through the NAACP or other, traditional civil rights groups, because that's how the Democratic Party worked. And I would go to these meetings and make these. I had this one little speech I'd make called Three Little Words. I think it was 24 little letters that simply mean maximum feasible participation, because that was the law, the Economic Opportunity Act of 1964, said, and this was Bobby Kennedy's greatest contribution to statutory writing and construction, was that the programs had to be designed with the maximum feasible participation by the people to be served. The theory being that most welfare and social service programs that existed for poor people were designed by, you know, middle-class, professional white people who had no idea what it was like to be broke. And that the very act of being involved in the design and setting up and then administering programs itself, that in itself was a liberating and uplifting psychological experience, which I agree with, although the Paulo Freirean ideas, which Paulo was writing at that time, Pedagogy of the Oppressed and other, and Fanon was also, it's interesting, Fanon comes out in 64 with, you know, The Wretched of the Earth, and Apollo comes out, I think in 65 with Pedagogy of the Oppressed, and they, both of them, who I consider my, you know, philosophical and psychological gurus, would have never accepted what we'll call the Kennedy liberal Democrat theory, that maximum feasible that the maximum and maximum feasible participation consisted of 1/3. In other words, if you set up a community action agency, that's what we called them, and I did that in all seven of those counties, you had 1/3 poor people on, 1/3 of professional social service bureaucrats on it, and 1/3 politicians on it. And that was the formula that was suggested by, you know, the anti-poverty people. It's called OEO, the Office of Economic Opportunity. You know, if people did that 1/3, 1/3, 1/3, that would meet the maximum in maximum feasible participation. And I've always laughed about that, as I had, you know, it's, there's no way I can say how much experience I've had with that that concept. I've written a lot of stuff, because the three-legged stool idea, which I didn't invent the name, but it certainly did fit for that thing, and that you know, that you can, if you take one leg off a three-legged stool, the rich people can still sit on it. You can still sit on a three-legged stool, and they would. Traditionally, what they would do would be get, after a while, you get these kind of professional poor people that would get on these boards, and, you know, they were very good people generally, but they would tend to say, well, they're the spokesperson for all the poor people in D.C. or Alexandria or wherever, and and immediately when you work with it and you began to see how all these little tricks played out, you saw that the only real hope was to build an indigenous, we call it indigent poor people's groups that were 100% poor, and that would elect their own leadership, and would and there wasn't a kind of a softening, demilitantizing of function in it, and that those groups themselves then you try to get money to them to do what they wanted to do, and the one philosophical thing or lesson that I can recall from those early days is like 64 or 65, and just working with people off the street, young people and older people, mainly African American, was, you know, this guy telling me that, I said, what do you think the definition of poverty is? And he says, well, you're broke. And I'll never forget that having no money is really the definition of poverty. And a lot of the psychological ideas that Silverman, you know, Crisis in Black and White, there was all these books that were coming out about that time that were having, Michael Harrington did this book that they claim was a big thing that started the poverty war, The Poor in America or something like that. My friend down the mountains did a book called Night Comes to the Cumberlands, Harry Caudill. That was supposed to be the book that started the poverty war in Appalachia. And there was a tendency on the part of a lot of these liberal academic kind of analyses of poverty about a kind of psychological thing, that it was a psychological state. And although I got a master's in psychology, but I've been studying it and thinking about it quite a bit, and at the same time starting to become much more radical in my political views during that the mid 60s, and you know, the psychological effects of living in poverty, about 80% of them can be taken care of with money. And that this whole, there was this whole thing about self-esteem. There was a thing about Head Start. I helped design all the Head Start programs in the suburbs of Northern Virginia and Prince George's, the largest, ninth largest school system in the country. I helped design the Head Start program there. And I can remember I'd read enough of this stuff. I knew how to talk the lingo. And I'd go in and say, well, we need to put mirrors up and so these little kids can see themselves. And, you know, it's like this fairy tale, looking in the lake and seeing yourself. Or get Polaroid cameras, let the kids take pictures. And all this is self-pictures and self-image. And if you'll recall, the 1954 Brown versus Board decision came off of some psychological studies that had been done of black kids with their self-pictures, and that they saw themselves as, you know, less worthwhile or something than white kids and stuff like that. And that was supposed to be a big thing that got Justice Warren and three or four people just swung them over. And that was a big deal during that whole period. I'm afraid it's lost. That's why I'm talking about it. But there's this kind of psychological aspect of how we're damaging African-Americans in particular, but, you know, and poor kids in general. And their self-esteem is low. Their self-pictures were ambiguous, and they had self-hatred. And so Head Start was designed, I mean, part of the whole thrust of Head Start, which was actually thought up by Sergeant Shriver's personal physician who lived in Fairfax County where I was working, a really interesting guy. And if he were still alive, I don't know, he would tell you the same thing. I told him, you know, it was a lot of it was just a liberal, it was the kind of thing that liberals could understand and you could get the, it's kind of a, oh, aren't they, those poor little kids, let's help them have a better self-picture. I mean, the good thing about Head Start, I thought Head Start was a wonderful program, still is, but the good thing was physicals. They give the kids physical, they make sure they could see all right, you know, the, give them eye tests and ear tests and stuff like that. And certainly the stimulation, you know, I'm a great believer in you know, if you want kids to be literate, you have to read to them and get them to love books and turn the damn TV off and stuff like that. All of those ideas were very sound educational ideas, but there was a major gap in the planning and implementation of those early childhood programs, and still exists, of not putting the parents to work. If the parents could make a decent living and didn't have to work three jobs and could go to PTA meetings and take interest in their kids and stuff, it would make a big difference in how the kids did. So just to sum up that, what I was just saying, that first couple years, I was in seventh heaven, you know, driving around, going to these meetings, telling people, I'll help you write these proposals. You, all you got to do is get organized, do this, and we can get some money, and you can actually carry out some programs in your community, some job development programs, which is what I still believe is the most important thing to fight poverty, is good jobs. And Neighborhood Youth Corps, starting community newspapers. I started about 8 community newspapers in the Washington area. And Head Start, and, you know, just and leaning on recreation department, welfare departments, health departments, and the schools to become more sensitive to in the way they treated poor people. Most programs, and it still is the case, are designed by middle class white people. Most school programs are, and well, I think I'd said last time, like my black kids who all played football didn't get home from school until 9 o'clock at night because there weren't any buses for them. And that's still the case. It's the case today here in Orange County, North Carolina, where we're sitting, is that the schools will set up after-school programs, assuming that parents will come and pick their kids up when they get done with them. and eliminating a lot of kids whose parents either are working or don't have cars. And the kids have to, if they take part in it, they have to walk home or something. Just little insensitive things like that still exist today. And they can't understand why the parents don't love the schools and the kids don't love them. Anyway, that's kind of the first couple years. The other thing I did during that, we did a big voter registration drive for LBJ, registered in Northern Virginia. I helped organize that. I worked with Vernon Jordan, who came up. We had a meeting with him, and he had some money. I think he gave us like $10,000 to, you know, hire people and go out and do door-to-door and register people to vote. And we probably put, well, I know in Gum Springs, the one area where we worked, we put 350 people on the rolls out of 1,000 people that lived in this one little community. So that was the first time I ever done anything like that. And it was obvious, you know, when you do electoral work, particularly voter registration, and you flex that muscle at the polls, like the next year we would start getting letters from politicians and stuff, you know, what can we do for Ghost Race? I'm like, now, we'd never had that before. And we'd been raising hell. We'd been demonstrating. We'd shut down the traffic on Route 1 one Saturday for 3 hours and doing all kinds of other things. And nobody's paid any attention. I mean, we'd been impressed, but nothing would happen. And suddenly, so that was a lesson that I never forgot, that, you know, it's not an either-or thing of direct action and electoral work. You got to do both of them. And, in fact, you know, that... you know, we began, when Ralph Showalter, who had hired me, he's kind of semi got a promotion over to do something else within UPO. And then I took at least part of his job, which was the director of the suburban programs from 65 to 66. And all of these programs that we'd helped get funded, I didn't direct them because they were directed by the local groups, but I was sort of the coordinator and tried to advocate for them wherever I could and stuff like that, and keep them going and keep some other things happening. And I was about 28 then, and you know, great experience in terms of we had about $10 million worth of programs going on that we were supposed to keep track of and everything, and I learned a lot from that, you know, from a kind of a bureaucratic point of view. It took me a little bit out of, you know, just regular organizing, but I was able to hire ex-SNCC people who would come back to Washington. This is when I really started meeting, like, Rap Brown and Stokely. Both of them were Howard guys. Charles McDew went to work for me directly, who was the first chair of SNCC. Charles Jones, who had worked in Alabama, and my secretary, Charlene, used to go with Charlie Sherrod, and, you know, I began to get a little sense of this whole other world. Marion Barry had come to Washington and had set up the SNCC office there in Washington, I think about 65, and we ran out of my office, at least partly, the first boycott that we boycotted. He set up a boycott of the buses, and we used a lot of the suburban workers to help that. And he had a Free D.C. movement. We did began a boycott of the downtown department stores, that, you know, had to hire more black people and stuff. And we did we tried to take over this. There was 12 co-op stores, grocery stores in the suburbs and none downtown. And Marion and some other SNCC people, and I was one of the five people that ran for the board of this Greenbelt Cooperative. You know, and our slate was that our program was that we would shut down a couple of suburban stores and build some right down the middle of the ghetto, and you know, with cheaper things, and people could own the stores and get consumer discounts, and we would hire just black people and have black things, and that was a fairly interesting little struggle that we did.
Did you win?
No, but we had considerable effect. I mean, because it was a real thing. It wasn't just a threat to do it. We ran, and the problem with a lot of it was all of us who agreed to do it were just busy as hell doing other things. So that it was kind of this, we just loved the idea, but the Washington Star did an axe job on, there was this guy named L.D. Pratt that was a white guy that was, they said was kind of this Rasputin figure behind Marion Barry, that had come up with all these schemes, and so it was semi red baiting and semi just that this guy was, you know, somehow corrupt, and it was a mess. Sometimes somebody should do a history of that.
I want to back up a little bit. You told me last time a little bit about Access, the group that you mm-hmm. were doing. You want to tell me a little bit about
that? Yeah, that was a. It might have already come across, but I always had this, I still do have this great fear of, I know that I can play this kind of liberal reformist game, and I'm a good word merchant, you know, I can write, I can talk and everything. So it's fairly easy for me to move into positions where I can, George Bernard Shaw says those that can do and those that can't teach. And it's kind of, I always think of that as fairly easy to move into a teaching role. And it's like teaching law school as opposed to being out here and fighting for people. It's two different jobs. And it didn't take too long once I got into this poverty war bureaucracy to realize that there was a trick involved. And I tried to give you some of the theoretical reasons,
right.
This
mm-hmm.
three-legged stool and all these other. So we had this small army of people that were on the poverty on the poverty payroll. You know, we had like 40, 50 people that were reported to me, or whatever you want to call it, from a bureaucratic point of view. And there's always this tendency, particularly among poor people, which we tried to hire, but mainly poor people that we hired. I think out of the 50 people, about 40 of them were, you know, poor black people that didn't have jobs before they went to work for us. And we were trying to train them to be good organizers, basically. And but there's a tendency to become a bureaucrat, read the Washington Post in the morning, and smoke a cigarette and drink coffee, and every once in a while talk on the phone and everything. And that, somehow that's going to do something about poverty. And So
what was Access?
Well, there's some friends of mine. I can't remember I was involved in it. I did help name it, I remember. So I was at some of the early meetings, but all of us were concerned about the... Yeah.
Sorry.
You got these early meetings.
Yeah. And the problem was we call it the noose. There was the white suburban noose around the black inner city. Washington was about 70-80% black. Suburbs were about 85. Well, if you took them all, they were probably 85%. Prince George's in Maryland now it's almost 50-50, maybe predominantly black, but then it was probably 30% black and 70% white. It's the biggest of the suburban counties, and actually has more people living in it than D.C. does. But the housing, particularly on the Virginia side, the Potomac River, you know, was sort of like the Mason-Dixon line. There was You know, you cross the Potomac going into the South. Mm-hmm. And literally that was true if you go in Civil War days and everything. So, and it was a bigger psychological gap for black people to move over into Virginia than it would be to move up into Prince George's or Montgomery County. And here we had either on our staff or working very closely with every civil rights person in all of the suburbs. And so we helped initiate this group called, which we named ACCESS, Action Coordinating Committee to End Segregation in the Suburbs. And the aim of it was to tackle these big apartment developments that were all white that literally would not rent to black people. There was no fair housing laws at that point. And we had a steering committee, which I was one of the leaders of, and we had a newsletter that was put out. One of my good friends that worked with me for many years named Bill Hobbs and I and Roy Maurer and I'm starting to think of this guy named George and Hetty. Can't think of their Harris, George Harris and Hetty Harris. And, you know, like people that were Quakers and that just really wonderful, wonderful people that got, that kept pushing this and then core people. But it was a broader issue than just, you know, like desegregating movies and stuff like that. That's really, and voter registration, that's the thing core had been. This was, the fair housing movement has always attracted, I think, communities of faith or spiritual people that just think there's something wrong with the fact that the segregated neighborhoods and everything.
You mentioned last time a little bit about a sit-in at the Pentagon.
Yeah, we did these Buckingham, which was a famous, beautiful little garden apartment in Arlington. In fact, I had lived in Buckingham one time when I just got out of Carolina. That was one of our targets. You know, it had like maybe 5,000 apartments in it or something, all white. And we also, there was two or three apartments in Maryland, and we would have a picket line every Saturday. And we had 300 or 400 people on a picket line. We had Klan people come down. You know, my first experience getting spit on and thrown shit at us and stuff like that. It was fairly heavy. And we weren't making too much headway. Our demand was that to meet with the owner and have them sign something and that their newspaper ads had to say, you know, equal access or whatever in the newspaper ad. That was the demand that we made of everybody. And I don't think we had any. We had a couple small apartments, gave up when we wrote them a letter and told them we were going to pick it. But we had a real rough time with some of the big ones. We did it for like a year. And then James Meredith got shot in Mississippi, and the call went out to all civil rights leaders to drop everything and come to Mississippi and join Dr. King and Floyd McKissick and everybody in this what's called a March Against Fear. And this would be in 66. And Charles Jones, who was this ex-SNCC guy who worked with us in our programs and had been he was the chairperson of ACCESS. And he called us all together. It was a very important thing. I owe a lot to Charlie for this good leadership that he showed. And he said, we should not go to Mississippi. That's a waste of our energy. We should rededicate ourselves to doing something here. And so we agreed to do a march around the Beltway, going counter against the traffic. You know, as a kind of a march against fear. And people would, and every night we would stop at a church around the Beltway and hold a big rally, which was similar to what Martin and people were doing in Mississippi. And, you know, we'd have speakers talking about you know, how racist the suburbs were. And all of this noose concept, we were really trying to popularize the noose. And then about three quarters of the way around, and when you do something like that, and we all did it, it was a, you know, it's kind of a spiritual experience when you do something like that. Charlie comes up with his idea that we'll write a letter to McNamara, who was the Secretary of the Defense. And this was as we were approaching Virginia. See, we started in Maryland, which is a little friendlier, and then we were getting around to Virginia. And that we wanted to meet with him at the end of our march around the Beltway. And Charlie announced that he and a delegation from Access were going to go to Vietnam and talk with the troops. This is right about the same time. I don't think Dr. King had come out against the war yet, but SNCC people had. Julian Bond had been kicked out of his seat on the Georgia legislature and everything because he came out against the war, and several good SNCC people had been arrested for draft resistance in 65 and 66. But anyway, so Charlie said he was going to go to Vietnam and, you know, to quote Muhammad Ali, who's now very popular, you know, this ain't my war. No, you know, no Viet Cong ever segregated against me or ever discriminated against me or something like that. So Charlie did this kind of press conference. He wrote this letter to McNamara. And I wasn't at the meeting, but Charlie and a couple other Access leaders went in and had a meeting. I don't think it was McNamara, but with some pretty high up guy, and got them to make an announcement that all housing that was segregated was off limits to Army personnel, to all military personnel in Washington area. And that was a great, and that was in late 66, and it didn't, and everything opened up shortly after that, so that was a good victory. And I mean, it would have happened sooner, I mean, it would have happened later, but I think we got that thing to happen. The Fair Housing, a lot of people don't know, the Fair Housing Act didn't pass until 1968, so it was much, and it's still not enforced. I mean, the housing segregation is worse now than it was in the 60s. So.
Were you pretty optimistic at this point? I mean, that's a big victory. And...
Yeah, well, there was...
I guess I should back up and say, did you have a concrete goal in mind, and then... Did you think you were moving towards it?
I think that I was not thinking strategically. Then I was, my life was so intense, and my love life, you know, I had these three or four different women. I left Carol in 64, and I had, you know, went with three women during that period, 65, 66. And I was basically living out of I had this apartment in Alexandria, and then I finally moved in with this one woman. It's like living like a revolutionary, basically. But I couldn't say that I was a revolutionary at that point. I was just an organizer who was just working his ass off and trying to, provide by example this problem I was saying that, you know, just because you're being paid by the poverty war doesn't mean you're fighting poverty. You have to get out there and go against the man and go against the system. And that's what we were paying people to do. And, basically trying to push this oxymoron of a war on poverty funded by the government to its limit. We knew it wouldn't last that long. And the SNCC people who would come up from Alabama or Mississippi, you know, they thought it was the funniest thing they'd ever saw. See, like Margaret, who had just come back from Mississippi. I met Margaret during that same period, during 66. And I think there were two things that happened politically that both had great influence on me during that period, to answer your question. One was what was called the Green Amendment. Edith Green, who was this liberal from Oregon, got this amendment passed on the refunding of the Economic Opportunity Act that said that the governors of each state, and I think also like the county leadership, political leadership, could have a veto on any program that happened within their jurisdiction. And this was in reaction to, partly at least, to UPO, some stuff that we were doing in Virginia and Maryland. We couldn't even get a program in Montgomery County, which is where Sergeant Shriver lived, because people, you know, which is the most bourgeois of the suburban counties around Washington. And because of the reputation of that, UPO was seen as a black agency, basically. And, you know, it was seen as a D.C. agency, although we tried to project it as a metropolitan agency. But, so anyway, that compromise that Adam Clayton Powell and LBJ, well, LBJ, I think by then was, had pulled away from any real commitment to the war on poverty, by late 66, and I think that Edith Green, who was more liberal than LBJ, basically puts this in on the, that was the only way that they could get it passed, was to kind of, as a sop they threw to some conservative, halfway decent people, but conservative people, and said we can't have these radicals coming in and stirring up the riffraff and without us having any control over it all. See, that's what they hated. And that was happening nationally. And if you've ever lived in D.C., where everybody reads the Washington Post first thing in the morning, and these, if you're at all politically attuned, you kind of can feel these shifts taking place. And so that was happening. And at the same time, Black Power, the SNCC people, who we were very close to, Margaret, was, you know, was in SNCC, and I was living with her by this time, and I knew all these other SNCC people, and they were basically saying white people should go work with white people, poor white people, and also there was this, you know, I want to be very careful how I put it, but that the Black liberation movement should be designed, the strategy and the implementation of strategy should be by Black people, on the grounds that there were not, if you say, which I agree with, that the struggle for Black liberation, the strategic problem of the struggle for Black liberation in the United States, at least, is always one of trying to find reliable allies. And Black people have never been able to find strategically reliable allies. They've always had tactically, sometimes they've been able to have tactical allies that were good for a couple of years on specific issues. But there's no other grouping that has any kind of political muscle in the United States that has exactly the same strategic needs as do the Black masses. And so that's a difficult conundrum. As people of color, like more Hispanic people move here, and there are almost as many Hispanics now as Black people, that's going to present an interesting political problem, because certainly some of those needs are the same. Strategic needs are exactly the same, but some of them are totally different. And it's a very difficult thing to develop reliable allies. Just parenthetically, but my view is just consider myself Black, and I just do what I think a Black person. Yeah, I just don't worry about the allies. I just go on like that. I mean, I know we need to try to get allies, but we don't. I don't ever trust them in a strategic sense. I think it's like a Black person does on that issue. But at any rate, that was those kinds of political analyses were taking place among certainly SNCC people, who were Margaret's and my, you know, closest political comrades at that point, and we agreed with that, both of us did, and that was in '66. That grew out of the March Against Fear, the same thing I was just talking about, the continuation of the Meredith March. That's when Stokely and Willie Ricks would stand behind Dr. King on TV every night and yell Black Power, you know, Black Power, Black Power, and popularize that slogan within about 2 weeks. And of course caused Martin and some of the other leadership some difficulties there about how to handle that. And that's part of my book that I'm writing about. But you know, because I think that shift that was taking place, which had the FBI and government forces in general aggravated that and exacerbated the contradictions that existed coming off of that. I do know that every night after the Dr. King and Floyd McKissick and Stokely and other NAACP leadership, and other people who'd come to Mississippi to finish the march, would always repair back to Memphis and go to Jim Lawson's church in Memphis and stay up late at night. I've talked to Floyd McKissick about it. He was there, and he'd say, you know, they'd sit there and argue this shit out, say, about, you know, these different lines that existed. And if you assume that there was an FBI informant in that room, I mean, imagine the intelligence that you take away from that room. Everybody else is in the room, you know, arguing from their heart. I mean, Stokely and Willie and the SNCC people who wanted to move north, move into cities, were beginning to, they had starting this Black Panther Party in Lowndes County and getting letters from Huey Newton and people out in the coast and saying, let's